This is a Pinball News production.
Okay, thanks, Ron. Hi, everybody. So this is a presentation is going to be by a group of us here. As Ron said, it's a very historic pinball machine. It is the first machine ever controlled by a microprocessor. And I probably have the least important role in its history. I'm the person who accidentally stumbled upon it by buying it by mistake. And I researched it and through the news group and everything found out what it was. The other people to my right here are John, who's the current owner, who purchased it from me a year ago and got it to work again, which was not a small feat. He'll talk about that next. And Jeffrey Fredrickson over here is the original designer who in 1974 was contracted by Bally to do a consulting job with Dave Nutting, and they actually designed this game. There it is. And he programmed the chip. He used an Intel 4004 chip to make this thing work. So, and Randy over there has been helping these guys, I guess, recreate the brain, which was the missing part. More details on that later. So I'm going to talk about how I stumbled upon the game, and then John's going to talk about how he has been working on getting it to work again, and I think Jeff is going to pitch in with some anecdotes about the history, or whatever he wants. Anytime you want to jump in, Jeff, go ahead. Okay? So the beginning for me was a very innocent one. It was fall of 98. I was not a pinball person. I played pinball as a kid, but I decided, you know, we just bought a house. It'd be great to buy a pinball machine and put it in my basement. I looked around the want ads. I found a Flicker. Not this one. Just a normal EM Flicker was being sold down in Providence. I live in Boston. So I drove down there, picked it up. I think it was $75. And I brought it home. It didn't work. I'm an engineer, so I was able to figure it out. I bought a schematic online. And in a couple weeks, I had it working again. And I was so excited. This is the highlight of my life at the time. I had my own pinball machine in the basement, and I could play it every day when I came home from work. So that was great. And that was pretty innocent, just a new guy in a pinball hobby. You know, I was looking around the news groups and reading things about it. And I said, you know, the playfield on it was pretty beat up. Maybe I could find a replacement one. I had no idea that it's virtually impossible to find a replacement for a 30-year-old machine. So I looked around online, and I found the following post that was about a year and a half old at the time, maybe a year old. And it was by some guy named Ken Miller. And it says what you can see right here. He's basically saying that he has this old pinball machine that's been modified somehow. It doesn't look like a normal EM game, but it doesn't work, and he has no idea what it is. He actually is pointing at the end in his last sentence saying, how can I get this into the hands of someone who might want it, like a collector? And amazingly, nobody, I mean, RGP is a pretty active group, as you guys know. Nobody had replied to it, to this post. And I looked at it, oh, okay, I'll just email this guy. You never know, maybe he still has it. And indeed, he did. So I called him on the phone. We talked, and he still had the machine, and he agreed to sell just the playfield. He owned a record store or something, and he just used it as decoration in his store. It didn't work. It would just sit light up like that. That's all it did. So he agreed to sell me the playfield, and he sent it to me, I think, over UPS. And I got it, and so remember, I'm a new pinball guy. I don't know much about it. I take it. It looks great. The top of it's in perfect condition. I flip it over, and it looks like that one over there. And the one mine looks like this. There's a huge difference. So the one on this side has all the relays and everything you would expect. That one over there has nothing except for a couple solenoids for the flippers, and the wiring's all different, the connectors are all different, and now I'm really disappointed. Because I, you know, changing the wiring from one playfield to the other was not something I really wanted to get into, at the time at least. So now, oh God, this is what, you know, I spent more money on the playfield than I did on the game originally, so I was pretty disappointed at this point. But I decided, you know, I was a little curious too. I said, what is this? This is an interesting game. Who would do this? You know, so I emailed him back and I said, you know, do you know anything more about it? Where did it come from? He told me he bought it from some antique dealer, that and another one, and he didn't even know about it. He thought it came from Chicago, but he wasn't really sure. And I said, okay, why don't I just buy the rest off of you? And, you know, I thought maybe I could make it work again. Maybe it actually did work. He just was missing a, you know, some kind of a switch or something was turned off. So I decided to get the rest, and he sent me the rest of the game, and it too was pretty interesting. The back box doesn't look like anything like mine. It looks like that. And you can see there was a small board up there that says Bally Brain on it. This got me thinking that maybe this was an official prototype. I mean, it says Bally on it. Maybe somebody actually did this officially. And there was a tiny little sticker on it on the back side of that board. If you flipped it over, you can see that white sticker that was still almost legible. And it says right here, it says Dave Nutting Associates. to me, it didn't mean anything. Apparently, to people in the video industry, Dave Nunney is a pretty big name. But I decided, you know, it was right around Thanksgiving, and I decided, you know, maybe I'll just put a post up. Maybe somebody knows something about this, might mean something to somebody. So I put a long post. You can actually go Google it and find it, where it's pretty clear that I'm completely clueless as to what I'm looking at. And it describes the game. It mentions this Dave Nunney Associates sticker. It mentions the Bally Brain and the little picture of the head there. I didn't really expect it to lead to much, you know, but I thought I'd take a chance. There's a lot of people on these news groups that know a lot about pinball. Maybe somebody knows what this is. And guess who was the first person that called me on it? John right here. So this is 1998 at this point. And John emailed me and was very excited. He tells me he's into prototypes. This is the kind of game I'm looking for. It'd be great if I could, you know, he basically wanted to buy it off of me. But I was amazed that somebody actually wanted this thing, for starters. And I was also kind of intrigued, you know, what's the history of it? And, you know, John started telling me about all the prototypes that he has and all the different things that he's into and how this is the type of game that he'd be interested in acquiring. So we didn't actually, I was basically ready to sell it to him, but we didn't settle on a price because I didn't have the back glass yet. Because when Ken sent me the back glass, the rest of the game, the back glass didn't make it in the packaging because he tried to package it separately. Because the back of it is actually, on the first slide you can have seen it, but the back of it has some special pieces. It's custom made that Jeff and Dave, I guess, did at the time. They cut it up because they cut little pieces into it for the new displays. The next email, or the next reply to my post, got a little more interesting. Somebody by the name of Alan Riesman, some people might know him, but apparently he was a Bally engineer, said that it was actually Nutting, that he recognized the name Dave Nutting, and said that he actually did some solid-state prototypes for Bally. And he also said that it's pretty unlikely you'd find much about the game. Well, he's wrong about that, but he was right about it being a true prototype. But he did say that it definitely has a historical value for a collector, and he's definitely right about that. The more interesting post came a little bit later, I think the same day or the day after, and this was from a guy named Pat Lawler, who at the time I didn't know who he was, but apparently a lot of you guys do, and he's pretty famous, and he really knew what this game was. He actually worked, I think, at Dave Nutting Associates in the 80s, if I'm right, or for Bally. At the time, they kind of became the same thing. So he said this is a piece of history. He mentioned a legal case in which this machine was a piece of evidence, basically, because there was a lawsuit between Bally and Williams about patents on a microprocessor-based pinball machine. Jeff is the assignee of that patent, by the way. He also knew that Dave Nutting moved to Colorado after the pinball industry kind of died when the video games took over. And he said, you know, don't part it out. So now I'm reading this thinking, oh, my God, this game is actually pretty historical. This is amazing, you know. So I decided I'm going to do whatever I can and sort of research the game as much as I can. That's all I can contribute to this. So my first goal was to find Dave Nutting. I think I just started calling information and asked for how many Dave Nuttings there were in Colorado. There was a bunch of them, and I started calling them one by one. Eventually, I got the right one. I said to him, I remember calling him and saying, Dave, are you the... Do you move from Chicago? Did you used to be in the pinball industry? And he said, yes, I did. I mean, he's an older man. I don't know. Is he still alive? He is, right?
Yes.
Yeah. At the time, he was an older man. This is 13 years ago. And I mentioned to him, I said, I have this game that has your name on it. It's a Bally Flicker, and it's been changed to be a prototype game. And he paused, and he just said, you have that game? And he just couldn't believe it. And we talked for a long time with him and his wife. And they mentioned Jeff. I think that was the first time I heard the name Jeff Fredrickson. He said that Jeff really was the person who designed the game. He said he hired Jeff, who was a young engineer who came on and said, we can build a machine with a microprocessor. He mentioned one of the anecdotes he mentioned was that he thought that it'd be great to have it controlled by microprocessor, but he thought it would also be great to have a new type of a display. Because just having the old clunky display up there, even though you could do that, wouldn't be great. And he was at the mall one day with his wife, and he saw a digital clock. Remember, this is 74. One of the first digital clocks was sitting at, you know, a store there, and he said, that's what I need. And he bought one, and he reverse engineered it and made it basically work as a display. I'm not sure those are from a digital clock, but that's how it started. He mentioned a demo they did to the Bally CEO where they had this machine and a normal EM flicker machine next to each other, and how they showed them the games working perfectly, both of them, and then they opened this game and showed how it's completely empty. The base of it has nothing in it besides a power supply. The top has that little board that you saw. The other game, the EM game, has about 100 pounds worth of relays and all kinds of other things in it. And apparently these guys were amazed. They couldn't believe it. They were looking in closets around. Jeff could probably tell them. They were looking in closets to find where the actual computer was that was doing all the work. But again, it was just a new little Intel chip. Then he mentioned some of the other history that some people might already have heard, that they had a contract with a company called Mirko, I think it's pronounced. They're the ones that eventually built a game called Spirit of 76, which is, I think, considered the first production solid-state game. So the design of that game was actually based on this design, or Jeff's design of this original. Yeah, sorry. Okay, I'm running out of time. Sorry. Okay, my last slide is I talked to Jeff at the time, and I talked to Robin, who's in the audience here. They were very nostalgic about it. They told me how it used that original Intel microprocessor. This is one other thing about the game that makes it quite historic, is that it actually uses the first Intel microprocessor, the 4004. And Jeff actually mentioned to me at the time that they used the gold-plated microprocessors because those are the first ones that came out. And it could be the reason why the brain itself, the microprocessor board, is missing, and it's still missing, because it had this gold-plated chip on it and a number of gold-plated chips, and somebody probably just snagged it. At the time, we were really hoping to be able to find this brain. Robin thought they might have it in a box in their attic. She looked and looked and looked. She eventually found the original ROM code, which was great. Then I talked to some lawyers who had tried the case for Bally, and they said that, well, the National Archives building has a big box of all the evidence. The brain might be in there. So I traveled out to Chicago and met Jeff and Robin, and we went to that National Archives building, and we looked through this box of evidence, but it wasn't in there. But we did find a bunch of other cool documents and all kinds of other things. But there's a lot more detail of that in this article that was written back in 1999. I have some copies on it, and you can also get it on the web at that address. And I will move on now to let either Jeff or John go next and talk about their part.
What I have, Alexis alluded to, is I was able to acquire the game from him, and then it was to set about how was the brain going to be recreated. And at that time, Jeff and I had not been reintroduced to each other, which we have been since. And the thing that I wanted, and I knew from the documentation that Alexis had come up with, and I'm going to move forward a little bit. These are some Bally prototypes. I'm going to stop real quick, and just in the interest of time, we're going to move through some of this stuff. These are other engineering prototypes that Bally did using the blue fluorescent Gottlieb displays. Some of you may or may not know that there were also solid-state bow and arrows done as well. So the Flicker, the bow and arrow, then it was KISS, Flash Gordon, and 8-Ball Deluxe. Those are the main engineering prototypes that were done throughout the early solid-state era before 1985. There's the Flicker. I'm going to continue to move on, and Alexis talked about the Spirit of 76 and the brain board. Here's the gold-plated 4004. Actually, there's collectors for ICs these days, just like there is for pinball machines and everything else. And a gold-plated 4004 can bring up to $1,000 these days. So once that gold-plated 4004 comes back from Robin's box in the attic, I hope that it will be a good addition to somebody's collection. But the thing that I wanted to do is make it period appropriate. I wanted to recreate the brain as close as possible to the original nutting design. And you have to understand, other than some court documents, some patent documents, and some other types of nomenclature, there was really no set path for how that brain board was going to be reconstructed. Here you can see pictures. On the left is the top side of the reproduction brain board, the back and the center photo, and the third is the schematic. And I want to allude to Randy Perlow about the schematic. He actually, and we just heard his color DMD, did that concurrently while working with me in doing a reproduction schematic for the brain. And so this man must not have slept for about 6 or 8 months. He just, you know, to work with the cutting edge technology of the color DMD, and then also at the same time going as far backwards in technology to a 4-bit processor that is, you know, extremely limited in its instruction set and everything else. What both ends of the book that could possibly be. But the good news was is that, as Alexis also alluded to, the original code existed. And in fact, it's posted on IPDB. If there's any of you that have another Flickr, the code is out there for you. So we were able to burn to a 2716 EEPROM, and that was through the use here of an Intel 4289 interpolator chip, and that was the big deal, that it was allowed to execute code without having to use the bipolar ROMs that Intel had, which inspect very expensive and almost impossible to find and even harder to program. So once we got the code able to be executed and basically communicated into the 4004, then things started to really happen very quickly. Randy also did a quick version of some modified code just to light the game over lamp, just to make sure that all the circuitry that we were constructing basically wire by wire. If you look in this as well, this is all a wire wrap technology, which was period correct for the 70s. Trying to do any kind of point-to-point soldering was impossible from the beginning, just from the fact that I found out that when you hit it with the soldering iron, it became very brittle, and it was not going to hold up. So everything was done wire wrap, and I've also found that was how Jeff did it originally as well. So that was a happenstance or a happy accident on my part, but that also kept it period correct. Also just saying that once we moved on from that, we started driving the displays. As you can see in the photo here, the displays are finally up and running and with zeros on it. But we still haven't got actual code running to start a game. So I started about to shop out the playfield and realized that this game never was operated as an EM because all the tungsten and silver points were just perfect, absolutely perfect because of the low voltage involved. There was a few drivers, I believe a few blocking diodes that were failed on the driver board, but for all intents and purposes, it was still functional and the driver board was intact and working. And I believe Jeff even alluded to one time, he said, the game will work, it just needs a brain. And so he was absolutely correct. Once we had the brain and we had it driving correctly, it came to life very quickly. Once I completed the restoration of the playfield and the like, we got the switches working. There was the switch lamps were working. And the actual fruits of what you see is right here. And this has been about a nine-month process for me. There were some times where Randy and I were able to ascertain that, you know, drivers were needed to be inverted, or we needed to have a negative voltage rail to drive the solenoid driver versus a positive voltage rail for certain column drivers. And I really want Jeff to talk a little bit about some of the anecdotal stories at Nutting, and possibly also, but the one thing I want to drive home to everybody in the audience is that this design, Jeff's design, basically is used to this day in how pinball controllers work. You have your rows, you have your columns, you have your strobes, you have your returns. This was his idea, this is his creation, and this is what we use to this day in all pinball machines. So if Jeff, did you want to speak at all, or would you like to answer some questions? What would be best?
Just have a couple words.
Okay, excellent.
Yeah, I wanted to thank General Alexis for inviting me. It's been a long time since I've made contact with this industry. I was very young at the time, didn't really realize what I was doing, but I was also kind of, although anxious, somewhat lazy about having to work with that much hardware. So coming across designing with a microprocessor was my way of avoiding dealing with those pounds and pounds of relays and having to design with them. The logic was very sound. The trickery of using relays astounded me, but it was still just more than I wanted to deal with. So my answer was, after coming out of the Air Force and having dealt with programming on a Burroughs computer, that maybe a processor would be an excellent way. Although these were calculator chips, it was very difficult to actually get enough wires to drive all these lamps and relays. So the trick was to do this matrix approach, or this multiplexed approach. When we finally finished the machine, yes, we invited Bally down to see it. Well, we were in an alley shop. Literally, you had to come down the alley to get into our door. Those were fun days, though. John Britz from Bally came with Hank Ross and Iggy Wolverton from Midway Manufacturing that they had recently bought. And they had driven up in their limousine, John Britz in his nice crisp suit, gotten out in the alley and came in on our door and looked at these two pinball machines. One was the original electromechanical control, and the other was the one that you see here today. They played both machines before we let them look at anything or before we explained anything. They both played virtually identically. He was very satisfied with the play on it. It looked a little different. You know, the displays were a little funny. Other than that, it played just like he expected it to play, except it had some extra features, which kind of surprised him, things that they really couldn't perform with the relays. Then we opened up the top and showed him. There was nothing inside. So John was, as he had mentioned, incredibly surprised. He said he couldn't understand how this thing was actually operating. And then we showed him the back panel, and there was nothing back there either, except this little board and the Bally brain that we had plugged in deliberately to make it a separate unit to show him that there was nothing beside what was inside this little box that ran this entire machine. In fact, he didn't believe it so much, he actually climbed underneath, suit and all, on a concrete floor to look up in the bottom of this machine to see where the wires were going to some other room. So it was a fun time. Those were the early days. That was the beginning of everything. Anything you did at that point in time was like planting seed in fertile soil. Anything would grow. Nothing had existed prior to that. Now all of a sudden, it gave Bally an idea. They saw that they had to go there. And then that's what caused them now to move ahead into electronic games. And that was the beginning of time.
I would also mention, if you look at the back glass of the machine itself, I've kind of put a little piece of clear plastic on. That's Jeff's handwriting and his high scores from 1974. That's how accurate and correct the machine is. The original grease pencil or Sharpie markings with Jeff's high scores still stand to this day. So.
I'm still curious about this chain of evidence of how this thing actually got here. It disappeared somewhere after the court trial and resurfaced again.
Yeah, it resurfaced in the music shop.
So incredibly fortuitous that this thing actually survived.
It was a golden IC, it was a golden child that it stayed in somebody's basement long enough.
Yeah, what I had heard that one of the lawyers that worked for Bally said that most likely it sat in our warehouse for 10 or 15 years as an evidence piece. You know, they keep it just in case there's appeals and stuff, and then at some point they just get rid of all the stuff and people buy it as lots. And some junk dealer bought it all and sold it to this person in Colorado and then eventually to me.
Do we have any questions from the audience?
Can you make it run for us?
I can make it run. I would be happy to do that after the presentation.
Where did you get the inspiration for using the matrix and the rows and the columns?
It started earlier with a game called the Safe Game, if you ever remember that thing. It was a game that you had to turn a dial to actually try to crack a safe. If you open the door, then a coin would drop out. That actually was in multiple inventions. First of all, it was the multiplex lamps. That was the beginning. That was the first game that ever used multiplex lamps because I didn't want to have a lot of drivers there either. The other thing that had was this dial. The dial had 90-degree opposed opto sensors that used to, with serrations in the knob, to sense the direction and how much you turned the actual dial. That was actually our invention was the basis for the current day mouse.
Jeff, how many patents do you hold?
well, over the past few years, I've filed like 22. Prior to that, it's been about 54. So in its combination, it's in the 80s.
Before this project came around, had you spent much time inside, you know, like the EM pinball machines? Or how? Tell me a little bit about that process and then the thinking process of seeing that and then thinking, you know.
I came from a communications company just before that, and I had designed the first electronic tone-generated pager system. And after that, then I went and worked for Dave Nutting, trying to fix an old TTL game for a video game. And those things were ugly. You know, huge boards that were very difficult to make work. And so I designed the first microprocessor-controlled video game. And that also is a patent, but that's another story. Yes?
What can you tell us about the display driver? Is that
what? Well, we had... there was actually two microprocessors at the time we considered. There's a Fairchild F8 and the 4004, but the displays were just standard LED Fairchild displays at that time.
What were voltages? I mean, that had to be added in, right?
Added in to, well, I had no, the actually was a calculator chip. It was already designed to drive digital displays.
Power supply, right? What voltage does the display driver?
Oh, this is a PMOS processor, so we actually, although we ran +5 for interface to standard TTL and CMOS, I use CMOS, but it was compatible with TTL as well. It had a -10 volts to give you the 15 volt necessary for the PMOS 4004 processor. Those were fun days.
How did you guys decide on a flicker? And did Bally come to you, or did you just take a game and go to Bally to get the direction of that exactly?
We went to Bally. We were actually communicating with Midway, and we said, well, we'd like to do something fancy with electronics, similar to like what we did in SAFE. And they sent us a couple of prototypes that they had developed, the flicker, and part of the original 25 run of the flickers, you know, the standard prototype type of thing that they ran. And that's what we used to experiment on.
And the game is actually a really early number in the run. It's like 1,040 or something.
1,074 for the year.
And when we were looking through the court case stuff, I don't know if you remember, Robin, that we found a document that said Bally has shipped two machines, serial number something and this one, to Dave Nutting, Dave Nutting Associates for prototyping. So that was proof that this is the actual game that they had, although it was obvious from Jeff when he saw it.
It's signed, so we know.
Yes.
Okay, thank you. Oh, yes?
You talked about doing the multiplexing of the lights and driving the coils, but what did you have to do for sound?
We had just the original chimes in there. We never really changed that. So they were just other solenoids.
It's still using the chimes, yeah.
Yes. Very similar to what Bally did in the early solid-state era, like the bow and arrow and the 8-ball and Freedom and the one that you'll see in the clear plus one. They still had the solenoids driving the chimes.
And to finish your question, by the way, that was the first and last experience with pinball.
Thank you for changing my life.
I went on to video games.
We don't need to talk about that.
Right, I understand. Thank you.
Thank you. I also want to say, just on behalf of everybody, to say thank you for everybody's help in this project. It truly was a collaborative effort. I definitely had the opportunity, because of my other prototype experiences and like knowing what the game was, to try to get it there, but it truly was with Randy's input to recreate, Jeff's obviously input now with some of the original documentation that he did in his thing, Alexis getting a hold of the machine, and you know, finally deciding that it was time to let go of it. So I do want to say thank you to all three of these gentlemen in helping me to achieve my personal goal of being able to acquire one example of each of the Bally engineering prototypes between 1974 and 1985. So thank you to these gentlemen, and thank you so much for joining us today for the story. Thank you.